This is your Uncle Don presenting my 281st Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Catch me down south on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake or CHLS in Lillooet. As we were swamped with breathless announcements of gold-plated medals in Beijing, Campbell grabbed the opportunity to announce that he seeks a culture of sport in British Columbia. He looks upon Australia as a powerhouse of sport, as though this is an indication
of national
moral superiority.
You're listening to CFUR Radio from the University
of
Northern British Columbia.
Perhaps if our provincial government spreads more wealth around on athletics, the public will cease to notice shootouts in our streets, gangs flogging drugs in schoolyards, and homeless folk clogging sidewalks with their shopping carts laden with pitiful possessions. I don't know where Campbell's head is, but I know the view isn't very pretty. In relation to Chinese competitors winning 22 medals in 6 days, he said, "These results are going to move their country forward." The moral for Campbell is that we have to learn how better to provide support for our athletes. Gordon claims to believe that one champion athlete can inspire thousands of children to get off their duffs and participate in sports activities. An interesting observation, as star baseball, football, and other players on television seem to inspire not thousands, but millions of Canadians to sit on their dead asses drinking beer and eating junk food while idly watching their exploits. On a federal level, our Prime Minister doesn't seem to agree with Campbell. He's cutting funding for the arts, apparently not believing that children are inspired to emulate musicians, dancers, actors, and artists. No public money allocated to the arts is wasted and is better spent on foreign wars. Maybe I'm wrong. Perhaps Harper hopes that the example of Canadian soldiers killing in Afghanistan will inspire Canada's youth to get involved in gangs and kill on our streets. Sometimes it mystifies me when I try to figure out what this batch of conservatives actually believes. It looks like their moral compass, such as it is, points only toward the goal of gaining a majority in Parliament. Nothing else. Since Heritage Canada is having its arts funding cut, there'll be less for their bureaucrats to do. All that money saved from sponsoring arts will be available for more worthwhile projects, like a junket to Beijing for a delegation of big shots. Would that impress China's leaders? They might not think that a batch of 16 bureaucrats and a gaggle of conservative politicians makes up for the slight of Harper's being too busy to attend the Olympic openings. Silly as it may seem, the attendance of national leaders is considered a necessary courtesy if good relations are to be maintained. But the bureaucrats contributed to the Chinese economy. They budgeted as much as $440 per night for hotel rooms, for a total of $42,500. For telecommunications, another $10,500. For gifts and hospitality items, $17,300. Then there's the travel expense of $206,000. That's a lot of air miles. Naturally, this is just the amount budgeted for Heritage Canada, and we know what budgets mean to Harper's party. Other ministries sent delegations to those silly games, and we'll probably never know what actual costs turn out to be. All this at a time when conservatives have turned a budget surplus to deficit and promised further cuts in federal taxes. No wonder many people say this batch of self-styled conservatives isn't fit to run a lemonade stand. Are we seeing the beginning of the end of the American war against Iraq? According to Washington mouthpieces, the war is winding down and their combat soldiers will be able to withdraw with honor. I see parallels to the American invasion and long war against Vietnam. It took more than a decade for that war to progress from Kennedy's first advisors until the day when Nixon pulled U.S. troops from the country, declaring that America had won. It was not long thereafter that the puppet South Vietnamese army collapsed and the National Liberation Front swept into Ho Chi Minh City. It's quite possible that Bush, or his successor, will likewise declare victory in Iraq, removing his soldiers from the frying pan of Iraq into the fire of Afghanistan. An Iraqi puppet government would then be left with nominal control, so subsequent collapse could be blamed on perfidious Iraqis who would not fight for their own freedom. The difference between Vietnam and Iraq is the United States has built permanent military bases in Iraq and seems quite intent upon maintaining them, regardless of the will of Iraqis. The U.S. will not relinquish control of Iraq's oil, which it considers its own by right of conquest. Local governments be damned, the United States will be there for the last drop of oil. Thus go wars in the 21st century. We don't have to ask where the Bush regime's loyalty lies. It's obviously divided between oil corporations, the super-rich, and the evangelical branch of know-nothings. But how about Harper's regime? Alberta oil? Check. Evangelicals? Check. Big business and its rich owners? Check. A major difference between our nations is that America's government doesn't suck up to any foreign power. Then there's Harper, whose lips can often be seen attached to the backside of a certain inarticulate American leader. Canada's prime minister is supposed to be first among equals in our parliament. Ideally, he would respond to a consensus of those parliamentarians and not serve a foreign master. Consensus, as expressed in a non-binding resolution of parliament, says that Canada should be offering asylum to American war resisters. Here, Harper's loyalty to democracy was tested and found wanting. He ordered all the stops to be pulled to deport those American soldiers claiming refugee status. It's sad. The Canadian medical establishment is overwhelmingly in favor of allowing safe injection sites for drug addicts. We're aware that these sites aid society by controlling disease, reducing crime, and putting addicts in contact with remedial programs. Harper looks over his shoulder to the United States administration, which demands that the war on drugs take no prisoners, or rather that it put all addicts into prisons. Heavy-handed, semi-fascistic law and order control appeals to the know-nothing class that has no particular loyalty to democracy and personal freedom, at least for those not in their circle. Before I launch into my next item, I'll clarify the difference between a colony and an extraterritorial state of the United States. An extraterritorial state, like Israel, has a voice in the administration of the central power. There's a reciprocal balance of interest that gives it political leverage in the homeland. A colony like Canada, since Trudeau, benefits from no effective participation in the decisions of its overseers. Its leaders just follow orders. Their scope of independence is severely circumscribed, and when they fail to obey, as when Canada declined the invitation to join the coalition of the killing in Iraq, they are punished. Israel is the largest recipient of American economic and military aid. Israel has a cheering section within the U.S. consisting of some Jews whose loyalty is divided and born-agains who believe that the existence of Israel is a cornerstone of prophecies in their book of Revelation. Through its well-organized lobbies in Washington, Israel assures that its interests are foremost in the minds of legislators and administrators in any actions affecting the Middle East. Israel possesses the sole stock of nuclear weapons in that area, and it's determined, through its influence over the United States, to keep its monopoly. In no other way can we explain the fanatical, single-minded U.S. pressure on Iran to prevent its joining the nuclear club. Israel engages in no action without first clearing it with Washington. Israel's government, no matter which party rules, knows that it can violate any agreement or treaty, commit any action with impunity as long as Washington approves. Successive administrations have armed Israel to the teeth, and can rely upon it to do America's bidding. When domestic pressures prevented the U.S. from openly arming and training its contra-mercenaries in Nicaragua, Israel was enlisted to do the dirty work. When public pressure in the U.S. prevented overt aid to apartheid South Africa, Israel did the dirty work. We'll never know what other skullduggery has been cooked up in secret between the two national partners. With the Bush regime resurrecting the legitimacy of torture, Israel's past use of heavy coercion has come out of the closet. For decades, Palestinians have been abused in ways eerily reminiscent of Nazi treatment of Jews. Now comparisons can be drawn between the Nazi siege of the Warsaw Ghetto and the present-day treatment of Gaza's open-air prison camp. I guess we always learn from our tormentors. The latest revelations of Israeli methods in dealing with Palestinians comes courtesy of the Guardian Weekly from Britain. Israel completely sealed off the Gaza Strip from the world as punishment for having Hamas as its government. There remains one portal between Gaza and Israel in Erez. Through this portal must pass Palestinians seeking crucial medical treatment in Israel, as Palestinian hospitals have been starved of supplies and utilities. Shin Bet, Israel's answer to the Gestapo, has taken to interrogating the sick and injured before allowing them to cross. They're having to choose between receiving treatment or refusing to spy for Israel. Those refusing to cooperate are turned back to suffer or die. Are the American people outraged at their government's giving blanket support to the State of Israel? Not likely. their news media have been hopelessly compromised and will not be moved to report human rights violations. They continue to promote the image of valiant little Israel facing down the terrible Muslim states surrounding it. Any Israeli actions are justified as necessary to self-defense. Violations of standards that are roundly condemned in any of the official enemies of the U.S. are forgiven for Israel. Look at the way Iraq was abused for alleged possession of phantom weapons of mass destruction, while Israel's possession of real WMDs is forgiven. Saddam Hussein was excoriated for killing his own people, while Israel's excused for persecuting and killing its own Palestinian citizens. Isn't it comforting to know that Canada is not alone in condoning and sponsoring hypocrisy? My first lessons in practical economics came long before I ever attended university. In my early teens, I began collecting stamps. My mother gave me an accumulation from her childhood, and I added to it when my grandmother gave me hers. I soon decided to specialize in those issues before 1940 and only those that were postally used. That year was an arbitrary line I drew between postage stamps that had been issued for use and the explosion of issues directed at collectors. Governments and entrepreneurs discovered early that collectors of stamps would pay good money for bits of paper with no inherent value other than a promised service. If people could be induced to buy these bits of paper and not use the service, it was pure profit to the issuer. The racket was not begun in 1940. In the late 1800s, an enterprising individual made lucrative arrangements with various Latin American countries. He promised to supply their postage stamps at no cost, but there was a hitch. These stamps were dated and not valid for postage after the year of issue. The entrepreneur donated massive quantities of stamps to participating countries each year on the condition that they return unsold ones to him. He then wholesaled them to dealers who flogged them to collectors. This went on for several years, and those stamps, now well over 100 years old, still flood the markets and sell for a pittance. President Franklin Roosevelt, an avid philatelist, fueled the stamp racket by issuing all manner of commemorative stamps when he was in office. Many varieties ensued, including a lot that were released without perforations, making them a separate collectible. After World War II, new nations proliferated as colonies were shed. I can't think of one that missed the opportunity to print floods of stamps, many of which were never used for postage at home, and some of these were pre-canceled to assure that they could not be used. By the time many collectors reacted to the impossibility of gathering a significant proportion of the multitude of issues and countries by specializing in themes. Thus came the narrow interests in pictures of birds, butterflies, space flight, various sports, ships, airplanes, and no end of other niches. Nations gave note, and some entities, barely larger than the stamps they issued, produced long series of high-denomination stamps catering to the collectors. When some impoverished island nation, whose inhabitants lack shoes, issues a set of 20 stamps honoring astronauts, you know that the racket has become entrenched. The world's postal authorities have killed the goose that laid golden eggs for so long. Do you know any philatelists? If so, I'll bet they're over 40. The kids don't collect, and the hobby threatens to implode from attrition. As my interest in stamps was waning, I picked up on numismatics. At 13, I worked a summer for a milkman on his truck. If you don't know what a milkman was, Google it. He collected mostly cash, and I was fascinated at the number of old coins that came his way, some from the 1800s. So I started using my wages, a whole dollar for a seven-hour day, and then my allowance, to assemble a collection of coins from circulation. By the time I had to sell it off for college money, I had a nice array that went for a pittance over face value. Easy come, easy go. In the mid-60s, the price of silver rose to the point where silver coins in circulation were worth more than their face value as bullion. Canada and the U.S. switched to base metals for coins, and silver rapidly disappeared from circulation. Thus, the opportunity for kids to pick from pocket change was lost, and the field was left to those who treated coin collecting as a commercial operation. Governments were not blind to the appetite of collectors for ever more items for their hoards. At the time when I was collecting U.S. coins, I could assemble one type from each mint produced in a year for $2.73. Now the U.S. Mint and the Royal Canadian Mint produce such an array of monetized junk metals that it would take thousands of dollars to get a specimen of each for a year. Canada may have hit the absolute limit when it produced a 100-kilogram engraved hunk of gold with a face value of $1 million. Other stuff they produce has odd face values like $100 and $300, valid as legal tender, but destined never to circulate as the bullion and sales values are far greater. Thus has our government and many others killed the collecting market for kids. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. There will always be fads encouraging the pulling out of good money for good for worthless stuff. At one time it was sports cards, then Pokemon cards. I have no idea what else has come and gone under my radar. I was prompted to enter this diatribe by a brief news item about one Loretta Mesko, a retired Texas science teacher. Mesko is a member in good standing of the International Pencil Collection Organization. Yes, her hobby grew from a lifelong affection for pencils. How does one go about collecting pencils? How many kinds of pencils are there, anyway? The mind boggles. Perhaps her collection includes one of the batch my brother ordered from a purveyor of advertising paraphernalia. His pencils were inscribed, "Kill Your Parents," and he slipped them into kids' goodie bags one Halloween. He was one of a kind, my brother. Fair dinkum. I don't know whether Dion has a chance of mustering a majority, or if his carbon tax idea will fly, but his lieutenant, Michael Ignatieff, has a damn good idea for Canada. Ignatieff proposes that Canada create a Trans-Canada Energy Highway. As it is, we're integrated north-south, tying our electricity grid with the states. With this arrangement, we're vulnerable to power disruptions, such as we experienced 5 years ago when a short circuit in Ohio took down power throughout our eastern provinces. With Canada's electricity potential, we should not be at the mercy of foreign disruptions, screw-ups, or potential blackmail. Power lines should not cross our borders. Likewise with petroleum. We export Western petroleum to the states while importing petroleum to our east. Mulroney's treachery bound us to a perpetual obligation to provide oil regardless of Canada's needs. Right now, Western Canada's Petro-Canada stations are empty of gasoline, while the export of Canada's raw petroleum continues unabated. Granted, there are other factors at work, and this shortage is temporary, but is this a foreshadowing of the future? Will Canada's transportation and heating needs be neglected while we export fuel for American SUVs? If Ignatieff were to come to power, I wonder whether he would have the moxie actually to move toward energy independence for Canada. Trudeau was on track to do so, but those so-called conservatives, not having any loyalty to real conservation, opened the floodgates and wedged them open with the Free Trade Agreement and NAFTA. Please, gods, give us some leaders with cojones. Way back in the early 20th century, one of my grandfathers had money. Before the Depression nearly wiped him out, he loved his big cars. LaSalle's, Cadillacs, and Packards were his favorites. Cadillac is with us still, but LaSalle succumbed to hard times, and Packard barely outlasted the Second World War. In 1947, my family bought a new Packard car. This bore the name of the old luxury vehicle, but our model was more like a Chevy. The once mighty Packard Car Company made a serious mistake. It sacrificed its reputation in a grab for the mass car market, and it soon merged with Studebaker and was gone as a brand. Then there was ice cream. Yes, there is a parallel here. For decades, Breyer's ice cream was the Cadillac, or Packard if you will, of the field. It maintained a reputation as the best of the lot made with real cream. It charged premium prices, but it was the brand to put on the table for company. Not many months ago, I purchased a box of Breyer's ice cream and found it hadn't the texture and flavor that I expected. Thanks to Deconstructing Dinner, an excellent product of CJLY, rebroadcast on CFUR, I learned that Breyer's was bought out by Unilever, one of the largest of the multinational purveyors of factory-made foods. According to Deconstructing Dinner, Unilever stopped using cream in the production of Breyer's, substituting vegetable oils and modified milk ingredients. I've noticed that other brand names, previously bearing a reputation for high quality, are appearing on inferior products coming mainly from third world sweatshops. When companies go out of business, their trademarks can still have value in goodwill. These trademarks are a commodity in themselves, but those buying them and profiting from that old goodwill have no obligation to maintain previous standards. Perhaps Unilever intends to milk the Breyers name for all it is worth, charging a premium price for a mediocre product. It then may abandon that discredited trademark, moving on to exploit another premium name. It's a sleazy business, but that's the way capitalist markets work. Incidentally, I read that a group has bought the dormant Packard name for an undisclosed amount and intends to resurrect the old luxury car for an exclusive clientele. Lots of luck. One of the first pieces of legislation sponsored by our minority prime minister was a law mandating fixed federal election dates. It sounded noble of our right-wing friend of the people to be taking that timing from the hands of leaders who could use the power to declare election dates to their advantage. It was only later that we found out what contempt Stephen Harper has for laws, rules, and anything else that stands in the way of his will. The latest sign of his contempt for law is his threat to use a loophole in his own fixed-date election law to call an early election for this fall. His rationale is that this government is stymied in its attempt to pass legislation. We're supposed to forget that the reason for government deadlock is the deliberate, scripted conspiracy of conservative members of parliament committees to disrupt their operations. Harper's party even produced written instructions for its members of parliament running to 200 pages, telling them how to prevent committees in which they don't get their way from operating. Do we need an election? You bet. Should Harper be allowed to circumvent his own legislation to declare the date? I don't think so. Doug Strachan, in his CFUR show, Common Sense, introduced listeners to the fact that Milton Friedman, the late fanatical right-wing economist, was an early advocate of the negative income tax. I was unaware of this, or perhaps I had forgotten it, as it had been a while since I studied the dismal science in university. The idea of a negative income tax is both radical and appealing. The concept is essentially that everyone, by virtue of citizenship, is entitled to a share of the national income. It would see a certain amount of money as an annual entitlement to all in the form of a government gift. Everyone would file income tax returns, as they do now. A percentage of declared income offsets government payments until a break-even point is reached of zero transfer. Income above that point is taxed in a progressive manner, as is currently done in principle. I say in principle, as the rich actually pay a lesser percentage of income in taxes than do the middle classes, at least in Friedman's home country, the United States. Detractors of the negative income tax say that such a system would reward sloth and maintain a whole class of parasites doing nothing for their bread. I'll buy that argument. Yes, there would be those who preferred to reduce their needs to where they could live within minimal handouts provided in it by a negative income tax. There's already such a class who live, by circumstance or choice, on income transfers. Those unable to find gainful employment due to mental or physical disability receive help from governments and charities. Single parents of young children receive monetary help to survive. Those too old to work receive retirement benefits. A negative income tax would replace all of those other benefits. I've seen a modified form of the negative tax at work when I was in Australia. At the time when I was kicking around there, I came across a whole class of people, mostly men, who subsisted on a weekly government handout freely granted by an agency that was a combination of our employment insurance and welfare offices. Anyone could apply at one of these offices and make a declaration that he or she had not enjoyed paid employment in the past week. The applicant would then be entitled to an immediate payment of a whole $12. Even in the 70s, this was a pittance, but a prudent person could eke out an existence on it. There was an amazing array of people who did, indeed, survive on $12 a week. There were always bare-bones rooms for rent for a few dollars. Simple foods, used clothing, and frugal living could stretch that $12 over a week's expenses. In those days, before their government, like ours, was seized by fanatics, the people did not begrudge those who chose to live on handouts. In favorable weather, they could be seen in the public parks just hanging around and taking up space. Many of those parks, especially in Sydney, sported benches and chessboards embedded in concrete tables. Men would spend their entire days playing chess or clustered around players. One of my Sydney friends visited my rented room one day, and I invited him to a game of chess. He figured that we were an uneven match, so he granted me a handicap. I hovered over the board while he sat across the room reading a newspaper. I called out my moves to him, and he promptly responded with his. Without looking at the board nor paying any noticeable attention to the game, he licked me in several games in few moves. I concluded this friend did not lack work from any inability, but because it was beneath his talents. Whole colonies of artists likewise lived on the dole without notably handicapping Australian society. I felt and still feel that society is richer by supporting a segment that does not make a visible economic contribution, but which enriches it on a deeper level. It enforces the idea that we exist not just as financial pieces on life's chessboard, but by virtue of our being human beings. I would argue that those receiving a dole are exercising an economic function that our modern economic theorists seem to have forgotten. John Maynard Keynes recognized that a critical function of governments was to keep money circulating. By taking a share of money from incomes and wealth of those at the top and injecting it at the bottom, it was kept moving. This function does not enter the thinking, if it be that, of advocates of unrestrained, untaxed capitalism. As we see Western economies today, it encourages unrestrained accumulation, resulting in a flock of multimillionaires and billionaires who are so wealthy they've lost all contact with the daily lives and struggles of those who have to deal with the real economy on the ground. Thus it was when George Bush the Elder was campaigning and confronted a supermarket checkout where items were scanned by a laser reader. He expressed amazement, indicating the mundane chore of buying groceries was totally foreign to him. His food was served to him, as it is to the rich who are unfamiliar with the mechanics of real life. We might consider a noble calling, that of reducing the wealth and inordinate power of those super-rich so they can be put in touch with the travails of their economic lessers. Do you suppose the helm of government in the United States would be better served by a president who can't tell you offhand how many houses he has, or one who has worked for a living and knows mortgage rates from the borrowing side? Yes, I agree with Milton Friedman and Doug Strachan that a negative income tax could be a good thing if administered intelligently. It should be administered even-handedly and without inordinate intrusion into the affairs of citizens. It should be part of a steeply progressive income tax with minimal deductions and loopholes. And, best of all, it should see a reform of corporate taxes, assuring that those multinationals which rule our working and consuming lives pay a fair share of income in taxes. Would you accept a job where performance of your duties placed you in the face of mortal danger? A job that pits you against those who intend to kill you? A job from which you could not quit on pain of jail at hard labor and permanent stigma? A job where your supervisors were in their positions largely because of seniority rather than ability? A job where you could be a member of a permanent underclass having to pay respect and obedience to an upper class with the power to bring misery down on your head for the slightest disrespect? Well, step right up and sign on the dotted line with your friendly military recruiter. This person in a snappy uniform manages to avoid the more onerous duties of the military by acting as a body snatcher for the system. He or she will promise you anything to get that signature on the line. Oh, the benefits, the training and respect that you will receive as a loyal and proud servant of a president or queen. Yes, sirree, the world is your oyster when you enlist. I know I was a victim of that friendly recruiting sergeant who promised the moon and delivered the mud of basic training and 3 years of indentured servitude. And I was lucky, having found one of those rare intervals when the United States Army was not involved in any overt military combat. Earlier enlistees found themselves in Korea. Later ones landed in the jungles of Vietnam and a dozen other wars, unacknowledged and clandestine to all but their victims. Yes, don't delay. Put your life on the line and sign up now. This has been your Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo number 281. I am in the spacious studios of CFUR at 88.7 FM, and my rebroadcast can be heard on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet.